Krishna's and Vedanta's given one. And Radhakund appeared immediately after. Not immediately, sometime after Shantakund. Astami. Radhakund Astami. Astapriya is the name of Radha, meaning she really likes eights. So Krishna took birth on Janmashtami. She took birth on Radhastami. Radhakund took birth on Bahulastami. Yes, they're little children, but you know, Krishna had already liberated Aristasura. He had already made Shyamakund. He had already taken his bath in Lalitakund to atone for the so-called killing of Aristasura. He had already gone home to the palace. He had already had dinner with Nanda Maharaj. He participated in the evening functions in Nanda's court. And then he started to act a little sleepy. And Mother Jashoda took him to his room and sang sweet lullabies of the days before, interspersed with Ram Lila. And Krishna became so peaceful, he closed his eyes and yawned and fell motionless. Mother Jashoda very, very quietly tiptoed out to the door, looked back, and he's sound asleep. Then she very gently closed the door, very quietly walked down the hall. And his eyes opened wide, shot right to the window, and ran back to Shyamakund and began to play upon his flute, which drew the gopis there. And he told them in the best house, well into the night, approaching midnight, and told the gopis, look, there's a new kund at Govardhan. He's taken birth from Govardhan, just like Parvati was born from the Himalayas. This new kund was born to Govardhan. And then this is Deva Goswami's version, which overlaps with Kavi Kornapur, Sukadeva Goswami. Basically, it's a similar pattern of, you know, the gopis charging him that, you know, you killed a cow, boy cow. He said, no, it was a demon imitating a cow. He didn't like cows. He didn't like culture. He didn't like anything good. He was a demon. And I liberated him. I took bath in Lalitakund and in Mainukund. So I have atoned, as every gentle person should. You gopis have not atoned. Well, you have nothing to atone for. I said, yes, you do, because you say that I killed the demon and I didn't atone. I mean, you say I killed a cow and I did not atone. I was not a cow and I did atone. You gopis have never performed any such atonement. I said, we don't have anything to atone for. I said, yes, you do. He said, in a kingdom, all the inhabitants share sinful reactions of the king. Gopis don't have a king, but you fully accept your queen, who has sided with a so-called cow who is actually a demon. So now you have to purify yourselves by taking bath in my kund. So no, your kund is contaminated like you are because you killed a cow. So by this time it's about 11:45. And they said, well, you know, this is the original Bhakti Brigade from Manasaganga. I mean, they broke their vehicles, they made the excavation, which impressed Krishna, who chided, but it's dry. So then they prepared to, not buckets actually, golden pots carrying water from Manasikanga. The Krishna could not bear to see so much as a drop of perspiration on the face of his beloved, so. Actually, we should backtrack a little bit, because there's a sequence of events that's very significant. One day in the vicinity of Lalita Kund, before she had appeared, Krishna and Lalita Devi were relishing, glorifying Srimati Radharani, who was not present there at the time. And as they just immersed their hearts in her unlimited love and glories, the conversation naturally drifted off into a very interrelated subject, which is how to show compassion to the unlimited suffering souls in this world who have no access to Srimati Radharani's compassion. They concluded that they should excavate a kund and call all the tirthas from the universe to take up residence there, which they did. But then word got around that Lalita and Krishna are claiming that this pond is the residence of all the holy deities of the tirthas of creation, but you know, we're not aware of any shastric evidence of this. It appears that it's an impoundment filled with rainwater that Lalita has claimed as her own, and Krishna is just supporting this. Their desire was that, and then, you know, Krishna called for the deities to emerge from that pond and introduce themselves, which they did, confirming that it was the holy waters that could relieve the most sinful soul of the most hideous crimes. Killing a brahmana, abortion, killing a cow, etc. So, after Krishna killed Arista, he took bath in Lalita Kund, and then he created his own kund, and by now it's 10 minutes to 12 that he's showing off to the gopis, and they begin excavating their kund, and then at midnight, Jiva Goswami's version is that Krishna poked his flute through the dike separating Sharmakund and Radhakund, and the water flowed through his flute and filled Radhakund right at midnight. The glories of Radhakund, like those of Srimati Radharani, the sweetness of Radhakund, equal to that of Srimati Radharani, is the secret treasure hidden within the Vedas and actually accessible only to Rupanugas, those who follow in the line of Sri Rupa, who understands the inner heart and deep desire of Lord Gauranga, foremost of whom in our lives is His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, who in his manifest lila ordered that Srila Rupa Goswami's Upadeshamrita, the nectar of instruction, which in just a few verses takes us from the importance of controlling the mind and the urges of the body to the significance of the six varieties of loving exchanges which nourish the society of devotees, and culminating in residence, physically or mentally, on the bank of Radhakund, by which a devotee can prepare himself for the final destination, where he, in a spiritual body, perfects and continues forever the same kind of contemplation he practiced during his physical lifetime on the banks of Radhakund, which means following in the wake of the Sakis, the lady friends, and the Manjaris, those most youthful, innocent, selfless maidservants. This is the blessing of Radhakund, which Srila Prabhupada wanted printed 100,000 copies, and the devotees were perplexed. There's only 10,000 devotees in our movement. He said, you don't understand. This instruction is not for devotees alone. It's for everyone. And since then, millions of copies of Sri Vedashamitra have been distributed, revealing the most confidential secrets hidden within the Vedas, revealed through the line of Sri Rupa Goswami, leader of the Goswamis, who is Rupa Manjari, leader of those Manjaris, who share with us their love and devotion, which is unparalleled amongst all devotees and nearly inaccessible even to Narada, Shiva, Brahma, Deva Goswami, and the like. And Srila Prabhupada's first instructions for New Vrindavan included, make a replica or epitome of Govardhan with Radhakund and Shyamakund. Not for some cultural value. He understood that the blessings of Radhakund are essential in developing the sweet taste for the holy name of Krishna. Kund is synonymous with Sara, which means lake, which also means the essence, the most relishable flavor of some special nectar, which vitalizes the heart, extends one's life, and invigorates our spiritual senses. That is different definitions of Sara. Sara is a transformation of rasa, which is that taste, that mellow flavor of the different varieties of loving exchange, whose very quintessence is contained in the nectar, which appears to be water filling the impoundment known as Radhakund. The benefits of entering those material waters, non-different from Srimati Radharani, and infused with her love, her unique and exceptional love for Krishna, is that it imbues the heart of anyone who enters into that realm with a similar flavor of devotion for Krishna. After which the pilgrim takes birth in Shyamakund, which imbues the heart with a love for Radha similar to that which only Krishna can feel for her. Furthermore, the merits of bathing in Radha Kund fulfill the experience of reciprocation expressed in our bathing the Lord's in Abhishek with the various nectars forming Panchamrita, which are emblematic of our faith, devotion, dedication, commitment, and bhakti. We bathe the Lord's with charanamrita, with panchamrita in Abhishek, and they reciprocate by bathing us. In the waters of their own most favorite places in all the vast expanse of Braja. When letters were coming, instigated largely by Lita Devi, just piercing the heart of Krishna as he resided in Mathura, informing him of the plight of the Brijavasis, burning in the fire of separation, epitomized by Srimati Radharani, who appeared to be on the verge of death. And Krishna, for various external and internal reasons, would not go. Externally, he gave the excuse that, you know, after killing Kamsa, his wives went back to their father, Jarasandha, and told him what an infidel Krishna was, that while their good husband was so innocently enjoying with his family members and subjects, watching a wrestling match, so harmless, and then Krishna, for no reason, jumped up on his dais, dragged him down to the ground, accused him of killing his brothers, the six sons of Devaki, kicked him and punched him and took away his life. And Jarasandha, enraged, vowed to attack, and Krishna knew it would be 18 times in a row, during which he would make allies with other demoniac kings who would besiege Mathura from all sides. And Krishna needed the protection of the Jadus in the fortress of Mathura to meet this assault. Whereas if he ran back to Braja and Jarasandha and Kalyavan and the rest came there, it would be a total massacre. So he had to stay in Mathura, or so he said. Deep down in his heart, he was contemplating that the Brijabasis suffer more in his presence than they do in his absence. Because in that sambhog, when Krishna's before him and they pour out their hearts to him, they're so immersed in the outer world that when Krishna departs from their external vision and they go inward and find that he's more vivid within the realm of their hearts, in an uninterrupted state of bliss that cannot be disturbed by any circumstance, except when Krishna comes back. So he said, I won't go. Uddhava, you go. This was not liking to the liking of Uddhava, nor Balaram,
who approved neither of Krishna's reasoning nor his decision, and was heavily criticized when, after giving their very lives to you, you won't even come back. You send your servant. And who would have thought he was up to the task to deliver Krishna's message until he reached the boundaries of Braja and found a mellow, unfamiliar to anything he had experienced. So he's the cousin of Krishna, who would sit on the bed and lie on the bed and joke with Krishna and counsel Krishna, was intimate with Krishna, even looked almost exactly like Krishna. When he reached Braja, he realized that this was a heavy task upon his head. And when he reached Mother Jashoda's kitchen in Nanda's palace, and he saw the depth of their love and separation, he began to realize that he had been sent to receive a message from the Vrijavasis. And, you know, and he dreaded meeting the gopis. He could read the words in Krishna's letter, but to convey the deep love, the sentiments unique to each one of the millions of gopis, the innuendos in those words, Uddhava became aware of what true humility begins to mean. He spent spring and summertime in Braja while residing at Radhakund, and only with Srimati Radharani's blessings and guidance would he go on parikrama to the different regions of Braja and interact with the different Vrijavasis. And even Maharaj Yudhisthira, because when the Pandavas were in exile, they spent time in Braja. The Vrijavasis were happy to have them, but the Pandavas were so admiring the Vrijavasis' exquisite love for Krishna, that Maharaj Yudhisthira built a palace in Kamban just west of Harshana so they could spend time learning from the Vrijavasis. While the Vrijavasis was to celebrate having the association of Arjuna, Krishna's best friend, the exchange between the Pandavas and the Vrijavasis just touched the heart of the whole, eventually, Jadu clan. That was Uddhava's first impression of Braj. And there would be many to come. And the next time Uddhava came, he actually brought Krishna, because he promised the Vrijavasis he would make sure. And Krishna, who has to honor the word of his devotees, actually came with Uddhava. When the cows first saw the silhouette of the chariot, they became immobile. And when the gopas, especially that one who wears a red turban and who can't live without Krishna, had somehow endured all these years of separation, saw that dark cloud complexion within the silhouette of the chariot, he was paralyzed. And Krishna tried to make his way to his friend Sri Dama, but the ocean of cows which surrounded the chariot and rocked it back and forth like a ship tossed in the waves of the ocean force Krishna to get down to the ground and embrace the cows as he asked, "Oh mothers, have you missed me as much as I missed you?" And they all in uniform said, And then it was as if the cows were carrying the chariot, which could not move, through the herd. And then the welcoming party, you know, Govinda and Purnamasi and Madhu Mangal, who had a huge feast for Krishna. But Purnamasi kept telling Krishna that, you know, your mother's going to have dinner for you, so don't eat too much of this snack. And Madhu Mangal, "What kind of snack is this? This won't even begin to satisfy my appetite." And then when they approached the foot of Nandeshwar Hill and Mother Yashoda emerged from the palace, milk flowing and tears gushing, and embraced Gopal so tightly. And all the Brijavasis were chanting, "Uddhava is a true friend and a real hero because he's kept his word, he's brought Gopal home." And they offered artik to Yashoda Krishna because they were inseparable. And entering into the palace, they were inseparable. And only when Krishna told Mother Yashoda, "I'm hungry," could they be separated as she took charge of the cooking. And Uddhava was observing all these things. The exchanges between the Brijabhasis and one another and themselves with Krishna. And Uddhava actually began feeling distant sentiments of romance, which was totally alien to his rasa with Krishna, but at least tinges the hearts of all the Brijavasis, who consider themselves devotees of Radha, who assist her in bringing pleasure to Krishna. So, in the many visits in which Uddhava returned to Braja, sometimes also Daruka would drive and Uddhava would hold the parasol of Krishna's head. And also when they're from Dwarka, they would, you know, Daruka would drive, you know, at whatever speed Krishna wanted to get there, across deserts and pastures and valleys and forests. But they would have to stop when they reached the Jamuna because Uddhava had prepared there a chest under a banyan tree where Krishna would set aside his royal robes and his crown and his opulent jewelry and put on his yellow cowherd dhoti and brilliant turban, gunjamala, and as Uddhava placed the peacock feather in his turban, Krishna would place the flute in his belt sash, and Daruka would spur the horses. He'd know the direction to Nandagram by now, it'd been so many times, and then they heard this celestial music permeating the atmosphere. Is that a welcome party in response to Satyabhama sending a message that they're on their way? Or was it some special kirtan? Or was it just the unending mellows of Braja resounding from the hearts of all the Brijavasis? So, 100 years passed, and Uddhava was the first to notice in Dwarka inauspicious omens. They could not actually enter Dwarka. And he understood. These are indications that Krishna is soon to conclude his Prakatalila. And he went to Krishna in solitude and begged him, "Don't leave me behind." And Krishna told him, "No, actually, you're the only one who will be left behind. Because you have seen so much and heard so much. And you can't keep that to yourself. That must be shared and distributed and broadcast to the world." And then on that, just before Krishna's departure, he would not let Uddhava observe that final moment. It would have been too much. So he told him, "Now, remember what you've seen and forget everything that you've ever heard or will hear. Disregard Vedic rituals and follow in the footsteps of the gopis to absorb your mind exclusively in remembrance of me, enhanced by deep feelings of affection. Now go to Bhadrika Ashram." Both Krishna and Uddhava were blinded by tears. How could he be torn away from his cousin's side? By yoga maya, he was drawn away like a calf taken from her mother. And he proceeded on this long journey, blinded by tears. How did he find his way to Hardwar and Rishikesh, born of royalty? Was the fatigue from the long journey on foot? It was really more emotional than physical. Every step was anguish, because he would turn back looking south toward Braja, which is beyond the reach of mind and intellect and imagination. And remember Krishna's instructions. Reveal what you have observed to the sages at Bhadrika Ashram. Why Bhadrika Ashram? The path became steep, and the cliffs had caves where sages and yogis resided, not the gentle slopes of Govardhan, decorated with ornamented cows and cowherds. And Uddhava thought, "This, my master's gone by now. The Jadus have gone with him. I alone am left behind." And he yearned for the embrace of death. He could not imagine how he could continue fulfilling Krishna's instructions. Go to Bhadrika Ashram. What is there for someone leaving Braja? And he remembered the last darshan of Krishna, his face streaked with tears, bidding goodbye to his close friend. But then, from the form of Krishna, within his heart, painful as that darshan was, he began to reflect on how joyful Krishna was every time he took him to Braja. And then as his mind drifted a little bit into remembrance of those pastimes in Vrindavan, he was not aware that he was effortlessly treading higher on the path into the Himalayas, until that pastime would end in his remembrance and he would open his eyes and see the craggy peaks of the Himalayas. from the roaring Ganges deep below at the base of a cliff. He would walk and walk and walk until he could walk no more. He'd camp beneath the tree, but he couldn't sleep because the pastimes of Raja kept drifting through his mind. And every time one did, he was in ecstasy. When that pastime ended and he opened his eyes to find himself in the Himalayas, he again yearned for the embrace of death. But by now he's learning, just cling to Krishna's pastimes. Absorb your mind exclusively in loving thoughts of me, following in the footsteps of the gopis, and you will surely attain me. So he was more and more entering into Braj as he trekked high into the peaks of the Himalayas, approaching Bhadrik Ashram. And then, when he thought of the pearl pastime, filled with so much humor and sweet intrigue, he forgot that he was in the Himalayas at all. And toward the end of that pastime, he had somehow reached Bhadrik Ashram to deliver the message that gradually resounded throughout the world, the message of the glories of Radhakund, the sweet glories of Radhakund. And at this point, he didn't know where he was or what he was saying, where he was going or what he was doing. And on his journey, past Bhadrik Ashram, high into the Himalayas, he found that he was surrounded by towering golden domes on top of ornate palaces, surrounded by massive walls with a gate opening to a crossing over the sea to the mainland of India. And he saw his friends, the Jadus, embracing him and speaking so affectionately to him. And then he heard the rumbling of chariot wheels approaching fast. And he heard that voice, sweeter than nectar, "Uddhava, we have to go now." And as he turned to look into the face of the passenger on that chariot, Krishna, smiling affectionately, took Uddhava by the wrist, pulled him onto the chariot, and with a wistful smile, whispered into his ear, "My cousin, where were you? Were you hiding from me? Were we playing hide and seek? I was looking everywhere for you. I couldn't find you. We have to go to Braj right now." And the chariot took off in the direction of Vrindavan. And Uddhava was contemplating, "Where was I?" And then they reached Braj. And they reached the Aprakat Dham, where all the Brijabasis, including Uddhava, consigned all their sorrows experienced in the Prakatalila to the land of dreams, because they were back in the Aprakat Dham, which never ends, where the leelas never conclude, and where no one ever leaves. Uddhava had been contemplating that without the mercy of Srimati Radharani, no one, including Krishna, could enter Braj. But by her mercy, they were home, and they could never leave because the Brijabasis, like Lakshman, drawing that magic circle around Sita, the Brijabasis drew this circle around Damodar, which included Uddhava as well, from which they could never escape. Forty-five hundred years later, another pilgrim is on his way to Badrikashram. He had been a very wealthy merchant and wanted to end his life by contributing his wealth to the deity. And when he reached Badrinath and offered all his wealth to them, the deity spoke and told him, "Daughter Radhakund, there's a sadhu there living on the banks who could use a donation." Because Raghunath Das Goswami, he had also gone to Braj to end his life. After Mahaprabhu left and he took shelter of Sarup Damodar, but the flames were burning in Sarup Damodar's heart, he could not stay. He left. He took shelter of Gadadhar Pandit, who could not stay long without Mahaprabhu. He left. All the devotees were going to join that great dancer in the Aprakat Lila. So Raghunath Das Goswami went to Braj to commit suicide by jumping from a high cliff on Govardhan. But he met Rupin Sanatan performing their bhajan there. And his impression was that Lord Gauranga is still amongst us. He's still living in the lives of his devotees, headed by Rupin Sanatan. And they implored him, "We've been here in Braja. You've been in Jagannath Puri. You are aware of the Lord's later Leela. We are not. You cannot deprive us and the world of that immortal nectar." And because Mahaprabhu's most cherished possessions, his Gunjamala, which means Srimati Radharani, and his Govardhan Shila, which means Govardhan, which he gave, those items which for years were wet with his tears, which he held to his heart or sometimes on his head, he gave to Raghunath Das Goswami out of affection and acknowledgement of his devotional virtues and tapasya. And Rupin Sanatan interpreted this, that this indicates that Mahaprabhu's heart's desire was that Raghunath Das Goswami be the caretaker of Radhakund. So he took up residence there. At which time Gauri Kund and Krishna Kund, as they had become known, were just about just small pools in a paddy field. And he was thinking, "I wish I could excavate them larger and deeper and renovate them. But that means excavation, which is comparable to heavy equipment in New Vrindavan today, and I don't want to go there. That will disturb my mind and distract it from bhajan." So he told his mind, just abandon such ambitious thoughts. And after that encounter with his mind, he committed himself more wholeheartedly to the service of Gandharvika and Girihari, at which time the pilgrim merchant returned from Badrikashram and gave the donation, which was used for the enlargement, excavation, and renovation of Radhakuni. And Raghunath Das Goswami completed his days on earth on the bank of Radhakund. And as Sanatan Goswami and Rupa Goswami concluded their earthly leelas And he was thinking, all these great souls to whom I have clung have just, like pillars, all collapsed from my embrace. The absence of these great souls appears like a huge python just waiting to swallow me. And Braj, the land of sweetness, beauty, and charm has become painful to me. It's shameful to admit such things. But the only shelter I have now is Radhika. And as he was on the verge of departing this world, his very last words were, "O Srimati, all I have now is you and your kund. I am yours. I am yours only. You want to hear her, to hear him say that twice before he entered deeply into the essence of the kund and also concluded his pastimes in this world. But the writings of Rupa Goswami remain in the form of Sri Upadeshamrita. And foremost amongst those Rupa Nugas, Srila Prabhupada wanted that distributed widely in every town and village, along with the holy name, to assist everyone in experiencing that sweet flavor of the Holy Name, which is possible only by the blessings and mercy contained in the waters of the Radhakund, who appears tonight at midnight.
I apologize.
Sorry if I disrupted wherever you were performing here. Any comments or questions?
Would you elaborate, Maharaj, on that statement you said that blessings of Radhakund are, I'm not sure exactly how you said, are necessary to develop taste for the holy name.
Krishna has rasa within him. He knows it. He feels it. But he cannot taste it. Because rasa is the flow of affection between the hearts of different souls. Rasa means the mellow, the flavor, the various flavors of prem, which are all derivative from their sara, the transformation of rasa, meaning the essence, the most relishable flavor of that desirable taste, which is Srimati Radharani's love for Krishna. She is the one who inaugurates the flow of rasa from Krishna initially to her, and from her to be dispersed to all living entities who follow the path of bhakti. As we said before, the blessings of Radhakund is that by taking the dust of the parikrama path upon our heads and immersing our hearts in the mellows of Radhakund, our souls are imbued with a flavor of love for Krishna similar to what only she can feel for him. And if we chant the holy name, or only if we chant the holy name with affection, devotion, can we chant constantly and continually? Because the sweetness is necessary to sustain our sadhana. So when rasa flows between Radha and Krishna, it's part of the analogy of Surabhi. Surabhi is a cow who has milk or whatever you want within her, but she requires the assistance of a loving cowherd to induce that milk to flow. And the cowherd has a pot to collect the milk and distribute it to worthy persons. In the flow of rasa from Krishna to Radha, to all the Brijabhasis, and from them to all recipients throughout the world, the container which holds the rasa is the transformation of rasa, known as sara, the leg, the container, which holds the mellows, which are all fluid, that gather in the kunds of Vrindavan to contain and preserve the various flavors which constitute bhakti, without which our chanting will not be pleasing and appealing to Krishna. Radha Kund is now 35 years old, but this is the first year in her new attire due to fulfilling the proposal that Srila Prabhupada gave that we shoot for the rhino. Not like with a gun to harm any living entity, but metaphorically. We shot for the rhino, but then it looked like the rhino was going to be black, and it took some diplomacy. Because they said if you have a white line, you will change color. Well, I knew what color it would change to, so we'll take the white. So we not only got the rhino, we got the white rhino, and then we got two more white rhinos, because they realized that there's two more kuns here that need to be lined, Shama kun and Ovita kun. Now, with the autumn season upon us, and all the leaves turn golden, tinged with red, the luster of Srimati Radharani's love for Krishna, you can see that Radha Kund is also assuming a golden luster. So we're celebrating her 35th birthday, but the first celebration of her new attire.
Would you tell us, Maharaj, about the significance of the colors of the leaves?
Harki is called the month of Damodar. But the reigning deity over the month and Damodar himself is Srimati Radharani. And Prema has the luster, which is golden by nature. And Kartik coincides with
autumn in New Vrindavan, which highlights one of the infinity of lessons which nature teaches us about our relationship with Krishna. In the spring and summer, all the leaves are green because they all have something in common, which is chlorophyll, which is a consistent color. And Lord Gauranga's teachings, which put monism and dualism and everything in proper perspective, are Achintya, Veda, Abheda, Tattva. We all have something in common with one another and with Krishna. And it's important to acknowledge that common factor from which the spirit of brotherhood arises. But the beauty, sweetness, and charm is not in what we all have in common. That's in the difference between the individuals who all have that common root of Krishna, but all have a unique expression of the unlimited varieties of love for Krishna. Srila Prabhupada, long before he came to America, when he was invited to an interfaith conference in Japan, was very eager to go, partly because he knew that there were good artists in Japan who he envisioned commissioning to make illustrations for Light of the Bhagavat, the teachings of the Bhagavatam, specifically the autumn season. What does autumn have to teach us about our relationship with Krishna? He never made it to Japan for that conference, and the Light of the Bhagavad did not come to light until after Srila Prabhupada's departure from this world. But what it is, and I take a little liberty to paraphrase his explanation, that you don't need to go to school to learn anything. You can learn from nature. He said something like that. I paraphrase it in simple words. And Light of the Bhagavat is what is the lessons nature has to teach, especially in the autumn season. Now you can extend. You know, he gave a set of lessons which is like a categories, but you know, they can be expanded upon. Because how does a pure devotee see nature? He sees Krishna's beauty. He hears Krishna's message. He feels Krishna's love through every part of the natural order. And when autumn comes and the leaves turn because the chlorophyll is receding, the predominance of oneness, which is an essential beginning, graduates into the difference. And where is the beauty most enriched? It's not in the oneness. It's in the variegations. Variety is the mother of enjoyment. So in the autumn season, all the trees have, you know, unique color patterns. Although, at least here in New Vrindavan, there is a general overall golden hue tinged with red at Kartik time, culminating with the appearance of Radhakund, which makes her new lining imbued with the golden leaves which surround her banks and fall into her waters and remind us that the Mayavad, which is very appealing to those who have just been literally frustrated and traumatized by trying to cultivate relationships in this world, like to focus upon the oneness. It's all one. Yes, everything is one because it all comes from Krishna. It's expansion of Krishna. But the variegatedness in those unlimited expansions from Krishna is the source of beauty, pleasure, and varieties of ras, which gives joy to the soul and duration to our sadhana.
What's the Red Maharaj about?
That is the luster of man.
That's anger.
Not anger, pouting.
What?
Pouting.
What's pouting?
It's a very special flavor of anger.
Okay.
You probably do that sometimes, yeah.
I wanted to say that, but I was thinking it better if it came from you. Thank you.
It's so beautiful, Maharaj. At the same time.
And also, you know, the Lordship's eyes are tinged red in the corners, which is, you know, flavor, is the luster. It's a color which, you know, the luster of Prem is golden, but varieties of affection give it a red tinge, especially in the corners of their eyes, which are reflecting in the leaves of the trees.
Would red reflect maybe like sadness too, or something like tears, or like when your eyes get red when you cry?
Yes, because the leaves are about to fall. In the Terakadamba, where Srila Rupa Goswami wrote, when he described the separation of Radha and Krishna, the tears, the leaves would just fall from the Kadamba trees. And then when he would write about their meeting, the leaves would spontaneously regenerate and flowers decorate the trees as indicating their joy and hearing of the reunion of Radha and Krishna. Goswami's writings.
See, at the same time, Maharaj, that how do you call this? Variety? The longer word.
Variegatedness.
Yes. It causes a lot of problems.
Only if there's no common harmonizing factor. Mm. Meaning that Krishna is the pivotal point of all loving relationships. That pivotal point harmonizes everything. As we have used the analogy of the stellar system. In the stellar system, there are innumerable celestial bodies. There are suns which circumambulate the pole star. There's planets which circumambulate their suns. Moons satellite their planets. And satellites orbit their moons. And this grand cosmic dance reflects the patterns of Rasa Lila at Radha Kund, where all these infinity of celestial bodies are held in perfect orbit, moving in patterns like dance, but none colliding, except the ones that man shoots up in the atmosphere that crash into things, fall down and just clutter space with all kinds of trash. But the ones that are natural, they don't do that. What does this demonstrate? The pole star represents Krishna. Or just stay with the solar system. The sun represents Krishna. The moon, in the dynasty of Rishabhanu, who is the sun, the moon has arisen as his daughter, who is Radha. And then, and even Srila Prabhupada said that
You know, she's not as beautiful as she is when accompanied by her friends. The Sakis and Manjus makes the whole scene most exquisitely charming. So the solar system offers a reflection of Rasa Lila. It all moves in perfect harmony and rhythm, and there's no collisions because everyone acknowledges the same center, which is the sun, which represents Krishna. Conflict will not be toxic as long as we have the same center. There may be conflict, but it won't be toxic unless another center emerges called false ego, which means I'm the center. And then there is nothing but conflict. There will be temporary allegiances to soothe the ego, which is temporary by nature and results in more conflict. Harmony and balance necessitates acknowledging the pivotal, central point of all other relationships and conducting all relationships for his pleasure. Then whatever harmony, whatever conflict ensues, which there invariably will be in this material world, will not be toxic. It'll be a learning experience to actually help us come closer to home, closer to one another.
So, going back to the idea about, you know, very deepness being the mother of enjoyment, well, Krishna's pastimes, they're very enjoyable. But when we talk about them, we always say, oh, they're so sweet, so nectarian. But there is other flavors like sour and astringent and bitter, right?
And even here in New Vrindavan, we have all those flavors.
Yeah. So, but yet they're still always referred to as like very sweet, very nectarian.
Because that's sweet is the taste of harmony and it attracts us. But if we only lived on sweets, we would not be very healthy. And you can get tired of those at times. So Krishna intersperses them with other flavors. Some irresistible and some which we would prefer to resist, but he knows what's healthy for us.
A lot of anxiety in his pastimes too, and when the demons come, everybody feels so anxious always.
And isn't the bitter, doesn't it turn sweet though? It's like bitter.
Well, that's why we say bittersweet, because the epitome of bitterness is when Krishna appears to leave.
Mm.
But why does he leave? Why does he appear to leave?
To make it sweeter.
You know, Uddhava took the kind of main theme in tonight's discussion, but what was the essence of the gopis chastising Krishna when they reunited at Kurukshetra? And there they were appealing him to come home to Braja, and he said, no, I have demons, I gotta fight, protect him. And they didn't buy any of that. And they chastised Krishna that you sent your servant Uddhava to teach us how to remember you. We do not want to remember you. We want to forget you. So why you teach Uddhava to teach us how to remember you? And even worse than that, you told him to try to teach us to meditate on the Supersoul, to whom they had no attraction. So they were chastising Krishna. And Krishna actually did that. He told them, you know, meditate on the Supersoul and practice always remembering me. Well,
why did the gopis have to be instructed to meditate on the super soul and always remember Krishna? Because for them, the super soul is Govinda. And they were saying that your message for us to meditate upon you is ludicrous. We need to learn how to stop thinking of you. But that's not possible. There was a hidden message in Krishna's words. And he also affirmed that, you know, because the Brijavasis for that 100 years of Krishna's separation were thinking that they were hallucinating and dreaming all day and night because Krishna was continually interacting with each and every one of them. But, you know, Akura came and took him to Mathura, and in the middle of the night he just transferred everybody to Dwarka, so this must be hallucinations and or dreams. But at Kurukshetra, Krishna began revealing. And Mahaprabhu also did this with his devotees. He would reveal to each devotee a dream or what they thought was a hallucination. He said, you know, I came to you. And you felt this. You thought it was a dream. That was not the dream. That was the inner reality. Everything else is a dream. So, you know, he affirmed everything they had felt and experienced. But he still refused to come home. And only when they grabbed the reins of the horses, he dragged the chariot toward Braja, which we celebrate as Rath Yatra. This Krishna drawn back to Braja by the ropes of the gopis' love. I forgot who asked what question, but I hope that...
Alexander asked the last one.
Alexander Munya.
the question about, you know, you were saying that the rasa of Krishna can't really...
Oh, you were asking about rasas, the different flavors. Yeah, separate... Oh, I forgot about your... Thank you for reminding me. Separation is the epitome of bitterness. But we can't live on bitters any more than we can live on sweets alone. So Krishna gives the bitter sense of separation to help us look deeply within ourselves to find out that the heart of the devotee is also the Dham of the Lord. And Krishna's performing pastimes in the hearts of his pure devotees. And without the bitterness of separation, we would not find that deeper sweetness. But they're all meant to contribute to the various components of a healthy diet. And Lord Chaitanya came primarily to experience Srimati Radharani's highest ecstasies of separation from Krishna and to share that gift with all the world. And Srila Prabhupada also gave these same experience to his disciples. He showered us the sweet nectar of his mortal presence in our lives. And that terminated in this, apparently, in this month of Kartik. Shortly after Govardhan Puja, among Srila Prabhupada's last request was to have a picnic on Govardhan Hill. While he was on his deathbed, just apparent deathbed, just stays away from departing this world, he wanted to have picnic on Govardhan Hill. which put the devotees in a dilemma rich with loving conflicts, divided into two camps, basically. One that said, this is the will of Srila Prabhupada, it must be honored. The other who said, basically, you're crazy. The doctor said that if he takes an ox cart on the roads the way they are now, they'll kill him before he gets to Govardhan. So as the loving tensions and emotions are rising to a crescendo, and then Krishna's Bhamaji arrives and starts joking with Krishna as the devotees are wondering what is going on. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj couldn't bear it anymore and he came to Srila Prabhupada and said, this is driving us mad. This basically pastime that's unfolding up is driving us mad. We have so much affection, we are going mad. I said, that's my duty. But not to such an extreme. So if you don't want me to go, I'll stay. But that was just the one episode. I mean, there's a continual thing between Krishna calling him home and Srila Prabhupada demonstrating his determination and like Bhishma, who could, you know, choose his own time of departure, and the devotees fluctuating between the... And that wasn't fluctuating at that point. It was confronted with the bitterness of his imminent departure from this world, which, when it finally occurred, and we had first-hand experience of what Mahaprabhu says in Sushastakam, Govinda Virahename, the whole universe appears empty and void without Govinda or his empowered representatives. In that emptiness, in that grief, where there's nothing but darkness and hopeless despair all around and within, how can we go on without our fearless leader? But he had trained us and disciplined us all along to, in all circumstances, turn to his books, which was a really, obviously, only short time. And in his books, he found what he'd been saying all along. He lives in his books. His Vapu is temporary, his mind is eternal. And the bitterness of that experience enriched the sweetness finding he's always with us in his instructions. As Buddha experienced the Krishna's, always with him in his remembrance. So the different flavors in this one. But there's an overlying essence of sweetness because Srimati Radharani is the quintessence of all loving feelings, and she is sweetness personified. And we all like sweets, but it does not constitute a healthy diet alone. So Krishna intersperses other flavors to make our spiritual life healthy. Anything else?
How is it that Krishna is an Atmaram? You know, he's fully satisfied, right? And yet at the same time...
He's not.
How is he...
You're probably going to quote him in Bhagavad Gita as having said such a thing.
I just know that Krishna is an Atmaram, meaning like he's self-satisfied. And yet it seems like he's not really... fully satisfied.
In Nandagram, you know, Nanda Maharaj liked to hold his meetings outdoors because he's a nomadic cowherd. He liked the outdoors. So they'd have meetings when there was some significant topics worthy of group council. So, Upananda was actually, you know, by age would have been the leader of all the Nanda brothers. But he said, well, you know, my brother Nanda is really, you know, more advanced. My name Upananda means I should follow him. But Upananda would take the lead from time to time. And he led this one meeting by saying that, you know, you're not acknowledging, apparently, that all these Rakshasa monsters are daily coming to Braja to be killed by Krishna. And, you know, you're rationalizing that, you know, Krishna, that, you know, the Lord somehow saved Krishna, or but it appears to me that Krishna's not an ordinary child. And even reflecting upon Gargamuni's instructions and predictions, this child will save you in all kinds of dangers. This child Krishna is not ordinary. How could he kill Putana? How could he hold Govardhan and all these other miracles? So, Mother Jashoda, you should not be pulling his ear. And Nanda Maharaj, you should not be chastising him. Your son is some kind of demigod or exalted being. And Nanda Maharaj is trying to be submissive to the advice of his brother. He's saying, dear brother, I think you are also a little mistaken. If Krishna is some exalted demigod, or maybe you think he's, or he said, maybe he's some great sage or yogi. But, you know, if he doesn't steal enough sweet rice, or if the butter's not sweet enough, you can expect a colossal temper tantrum. Is this the consciousness of a sage or a yogi? Or when there's a little thunder in the sky, he runs into Mother Jashoda's lap and won't leave until everything's... Is this the behavior of some great demigod? My dear, Upananda, I think you're mistaken. And he would think that if Gopal is some great demigod or a yogi, and they thought, that is ridiculous. And they just start laughing and rolling on the ground. And just laughing until they forgot all the Aishwarya demonstrations that Krishna had revealed years before. Just forgot the possibility that he could be any kind of sage or yogi or demigod. He's just our son. So, Krishna makes statements like he is the super soul. But how can you believe that? And he says he's impartial. But where's the evidence that Krishna's impartial? He's highly partial. When Krishna makes statements like that, which he does in Bhagavad Gita, that's the super soul speaking. When he says he's self-satisfied, and he's not partial, and he's equal to all, that's the super soul within Krishna speaking. Because he is a super soul. But Gopal has qualities distinct from the super soul. He is partial. It's partial to his qualities. And Atmaram, self-satisfied? That holds true until Srimati Radharani comes before him. And he finds not only all kinds of desire, but unlimited desire awakening within his heart. How can you say that he's Atmaram or Aptakam? He's a plaything in the hands of his beloved. And he says, when he makes statements like that, that's the super soul speaking, which is one aspect of Krishna, but not the part that we worship.
Is that kind of like a reflection, like as jiva souls, we can get to a platform of being the Brahma Buddha platform of being equipoise, but that's not the goal. The goal is attraction relationship. Is that parallel to that kind of?
Yes. The first, I believe it was the first Radhasthami lecture that Srila Prabhupada ever gave, he said that sages in this world strive for that stage of Brahma-Bhuta. And to achieve that, Bharat Maharaj left his kingdom and went to the forest and practiced tapasya. I gave examples like Buddha. So, if these great souls are striving for this stage of Atmaram, of whom the supreme Atmaram is Krishna, what's Krishna doing? This is a Radhasthami lecture where Srila Prabhupada is speaking. He said, he's running after his girlfriend. What kind of Atmaram is that? So the Atmaram is the super soul feature of Krishna, which he has. He has his Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan features. And you hear different voices speaking or different aspects of Krishna speaking in different portions of Bhagavad Gita. You hear Krishna says, I'm not partial in anyone. Where do we find that in the Leela? He's very partial to his devotees. Now, the good thing is that anybody can become a devotee and experience that partiality of Krishna. But that's really the super soul speaking in those statements. He's not partial to any category that none of us can't achieve. He's partial to his devotees. He wants everyone to become his devotee, to experience his partiality.
If we take a little Radhakund before midnight, do we still get Radharani's blessings?
Yes. Yes. We should not wait too long. The most potent moment is midnight. But we can begin now.
Well, we want to offer something to her, right?
That's I brought chestnuts.
I brought pawpaws.
Can you say Maharaj?
Where'd you find pawpaws?
The whole bunch. Potatoes. And a whole bunch. All right. All right.
Those must be from Soma's cook.
Yeah, they're from Soma's.
Okay.
So, what would you say,
Maharaj?
What would you say again, Maharaj? What's so special about the chestnuts?
Because they grow on the trees surrounding Radhakund.
There's more.
As to the pawpaws, half of Radhakund trees are pawpaws, half are chestnut. When you get a little further back, they're sugar maple. There's a practical aspect also. In America, every fifth tree used to be chestnut, which was the staple, the main source of sustenance for the American Indians and the early pioneers before the blight killed them off. There's a personal part too.
Can we say it, please?
No, that's mundane. It's in the history books. You can read it. The tree's in the history books.
The last of the chestnut trees. Last of the original breed of chestnuts. was near your house.
Well, I never would have known because I was only this big. But I knew at that age that my duty in this world was herding cows. So, which was not really accurate because those cows knew exactly where to go and exactly when to come back. But I had this sentiment that I have to herd the cows. What I didn't know is the cows went every day to the shade of this one huge chestnut tree, American chestnut, that somehow evaded the blight. And they would gather around under that tree and spend the day there and then come back in time for milking. So when I was a little bit bigger, enough to figure out that that's a historic chestnut tree, which is in Soma's books because it somehow evaded the blight. Then my grandfather was a conservation man, so he engaged me in picking up the nuts and sending them to universities and conservatories all over where they tried to develop a blight-free variety. But meanwhile, the Chinese chestnut just took over, so there wasn't any real need. But it's an emblem of sustenance, living off the land in Appalachia. In addition to that, they are very flavorful if you roast them when they're fresh. The mistake was you got into some that weren't fresh, and then you get a whole different experience. But these trees are what, 7 or 8 years old now, and they're producing tremendous bounty. Not so. Srila Prabhupada, when he was here in New Vrindavan, staying in the gray house, which became the greenhouse, I don't even know what it's called now.
Greenhouse. Community Holistic Center.
Huh?
Community Holistic Center.
Whatever it is, where Srila Prabhupada stayed in 1974. Now, the boys were staying in the house at the time, had a garden just outside the door, and we vacated the house when Srila Prabhupada stayed there, but we were eavesdropping when he was taking prasadam. And we heard him say, because his cook picked from our garden to prepare his meal, and he commented on that. He said, this should be the standard in Vrindavan, that your garden is just outside the door, you pick fresh from the garden, offer to Krishna, and then take prasad. So we have since lost our garden, but we still have the trees. So to follow this instruction, we have to have chestnuts and pawpaws. Because they grow on trees, not in the garden. Furthermore, the pawpaw is sitafal. And for anyone who hasn't heard the story, when it's a celestial fruit, and it's called sitafal because it's Sita Devi's favorite. And the pastime with Krishna and the Pandavas explains how Draupadi, when Krishna visited, offered Krishna a pawpaw, sitafal. But the custom is you offer the fruit with a knife because once it's cut, it starts to deteriorate rather quickly. So if the culture is you offer sitafal to your guest on a plate with a knife so he can cut it and eat it at his own pace. Otherwise, it's dead. So Krishna took the knife, he cut the pawpaw, but he cut his finger. And it began to bleed. And Draupadi quickly tore off the border of her royal sari and gave it to Krishna to make a bandage. And he responded by saying that since you have given me a piece of your sari in my time of need, in your time of need, I will provide you unlimited saris. So these pawpaws and chestnuts are full of significance and meaning. In addition to being very flavorful if they're fresh and prepared properly. So there's enough devotees for different services, but someone should prepare pawpaws and someone should prepare chestnuts, and I think some want to bathe, because I don't know what Radha Kundasmi has ever been this morning.
I mean, so many devotees too.
What do you mean bathe? What the people have
I had a question. This is a practical question. As a pujari service, when we dress Radharani and when we dress Krishna, so what this should be our mood when we are dressing Radharani and when we are dressing Krishna?
Your mood should be that I'm not dressing either Radharani or Krishna. My Gurudev is...
My Gurudev.
Assisting the sakus, making tasteful arrangements for the pleasure of Radha and Krishna, and I am assisting him. And when you cultivate that mood, you'll find that the reciprocation is very much enriched. Servant of the servant of the servant. Does anybody actually know how to prepare chestnuts properly?
Chestnuts? No. Can't say what I mean.
He cut the pawpaw, but he cut his finger. And he began to bleed. And Draupadi quickly tore off the border of his royal, her royal sari, and gave it to Krishna to make a bandage. And he responded by saying that, since you have given me a piece of your sari in my time of need, in your time of need, I will provide you unlimited saris. So these pawpaws and chestnuts are full of significance and meaning, in addition to being very flavorful if they're fresh and prepared properly. So there's enough devotees for different services, but someone should prepare pawpaws and someone should prepare chestnuts, and I think some want to bathe, because I don't know what Radha Kundasmi has ever been this morning.
I mean, so many devotees too.
What do you mean bathe? What the people have?
I had a question. This is a practical question. As a pujari service, when we dress Radharani and when we dress Krishna, so what this should be our mood when we are dressing Radharani and when we are dressing Krishna?
Your mood should be that I'm not dressing either Radharani or Krishna. My Gurudev is...
My Gurudev.
Assisting the sakus, making tasteful arrangements for the pleasure of Radha and Krishna, and I am assisting him. And when you cultivate that mood, you'll find that the reciprocation is very much enriched. Servant of the servant of the servant. Does anybody actually know how to prepare chestnuts properly?
Chestnuts? No. Can't say what I mean.